Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this episode, the cover article of this year's June issue of The Atlantic magazine concerned a woman called Lola. My Family's Slave was written by Alex Tizon, a Pulitzer Prize-winning Filipino-American writer. Lola had lived with the Tizon family and cared for them since before Alex was born. She had come with them from the Philippines to the United States. To Alex and his siblings, it had always seemed like she was part of the family, until it didn't. The title of the article was not an attention-getting ploy. It was Alex's choice for a story he had struggled to tell. The essay had been ready for publication since January, but was sidelined repeatedly by Trump administration news. In March, Alex died suddenly and unexpectedly. When the article finally hit the internet and newsstands, Alex wasn't there to defend himself. His family took the brunt of the extreme reactions that ensued. Still in the wake of these events, Alex's wife, Melissa Tizon, met with her sister-in-law, Ling Tizon Quillen, recently to be interviewed by the Filipino-American writer and activist, Jose Antonio Vargas. Their conversation offers a depth of insight on an incredibly personal level into a complex human trafficking story that may seem hard to believe, but must be believed and better understood. Melissa Tizon, Ling Tizon Quillen, and Jose Antonio Vargas spoke at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation Visitors Center on September 6th. Sonia Harris recorded the discussion. We're presenting our broadcast version here. To listen to the full event, go to kuow.org/speakersforum.
Hi. Good afternoon. I don't know about you. Are you nervous? Like, I'm getting a little nervous because we're talking about something incredibly personal. Like, there's nothing more personal than talking about family. And so I just want everybody to just kind of loosen up a little bit. Just take a breath. Just breathe. And actually, Melissa and I were just joking, sort of, that before we start this off, given that I don't know how many other events are happening in the country right now where there are actually three Filipinos on a stage. Not as peripheral, not as marginalized, not as minorities, but as mainstream and centralizing our stories, which is something that we rarely ever see anywhere. So just big kudos for that. But when we were talking, I wanted, when we get started, to share our nicknames. Because Filipinos, our names are not really our names. It's always a nickname. So can we get, you start.
It was Bilingay, and shortened to Lingay, and now I go by Ling, which is actually a nickname.
And my Filipino nickname is Misa, which is short for the way Filipinos pronounce Melissa. They pronounce it Melissa. And Alex liked to give us variations on our nickname, so he made Misa miso, and then he made it miso soup, and then he made it just supers, so... I have a variation of nicknames from Alex.
So mine is Pepeton. Pepe is for Jose, and Ton is for Antonio. So you Pepe plus Ton, Pepeton. So my family calls me. Yeah. And just now that we're in that equal footing of having nicknames, I just want to actually, before we get started, to ask, how many people here are Filipinos? Can you raise your hands? And keep them up. How many people here remember exactly the time where you were when you read this story? I was at a Starbucks in Texas, is where I was. And before we kind of get started with this conversation, I think it's really important that we contextualize the story even more, given that we are in Seattle, the land of Carlos Bolosan, given that we are in one of the more... highly concentrated Filipino-American cities in the country. And given how rare, as I had mentioned, it is to see Filipinos and Filipino life portrayed in the way that it was portrayed in this cover story, And in many ways, to me, as a journalist, as someone who's Filipino and as someone who's an immigrant, I related a lot to Alex. Actually, I knew of him. I didn't know him. I knew of him because there weren't that many Filipino Americans apparently who had won a Pulitzer. So we had shared that somewhat in common. So people were like, hey, do you know Alex? No, I don't. But I'm sure I do. He's a kuya, because everybody in the family is a kuya, older brother. But it was fascinating reading this essay, and that's why I'm so I feel so privileged that Melissa and Ling asked me to join them tonight, because it was almost as if in our culture there's a word called hiya, which means shame, which means you're not supposed to talk about certain things. And as I kept reading and flipping and reading and highlighting and reading, I kept thinking, this is like one big secret that a family, I can only imagine what must that have been like to tell that story. And not just within family, but to share it with everybody else. Because once you share, Melissa and I were talking, once you share a story, it's not yours anymore, right? All of a sudden, people project all of their biases and their own personal feelings and histories to something that's not theirs, but now they feel like it's theirs. So I kind of want to start with that, with both of you, is to really talk about the process of the story. Melissa, I remember when you and I first talked on the phone, I was asking, and I want to ask you now, like, how long has this story kind of been in waiting for Alex?
Well, Alex wanted to write the story at least 5 years ago, possibly 7 years ago. Lola died 5 years ago, and he had started it in fits and starts over that period of time, and he could just never get it right. So, and he just kept putting it down and walking away from it. And then in September of this year, he wrote it for The Atlantic, and it just flowed out of him for some reason. It just came out, and it was beautiful. And he, you know, as a writer, the writing process was always very difficult for him. But with this time in September, it wasn't difficult at all.
You mean like September 2016?
September 2016. Yeah. It just flowed out of him, and he turned it into The Atlantic, and there he had a great editor who he really connected with, and she made him a better writer. And they went through 7 versions of the draft by the time that he passed away. And he didn't know. It was supposed to run in January, but because of all the things that were happening with Trump, the story kept getting pushed and pushed and pushed to the point where he didn't think it was ever going to run. And, you know, and then he died on March 23rd. And on March 23rd, The Atlantic had been trying to get a hold of him to say, hey, guess what? You're going to be on the cover of the June issue of our magazine. And when he didn't respond, they got really worried. And Jeff Goldberg, the chief editor for The Atlantic, was actually supposed to have the cover for June. He had a story that was supposed to be the cover. But he read Alex's and said, no, it's got to be this. And I was, they call it, you know, Ling and I were at the funeral home, and The Atlantic called my cell phone, and they were so sorry to hear about Alex's loss, and they said, but we want to make this the cover. What do you guys think? And we said, yeah, this was the most important thing to him.
So, Ling, so kind of in the timeline of this, so September 2016, it comes pouring out of Alex, right? Ling, from your perspective as one of Alex's siblings, what did he tell you that he was working on this? Did he ask for permission? Did he? I'm just curious. Like, what was that like?
So after Lola passed, I think we all knew that he'd eventually write a story on Lola, whether it was an article or a book. So I think we'd ask him periodically, when's that story coming out? What are you writing? And he ended up, writing his book. And publishing that. And then after that, it was one of those, now he's going to focus and concentrate on Lola's story. But I think as far as what he was going to write, you know, he kept that pretty close to the vest. He didn't share it with the siblings anyway. But he did forewarn. I remember one conversation when he said, you know, it's not going to be what you might think. It's not going to be this kind of rosy picture, but he shared the first draft with us siblings October 2016.
The first of the seven drafts.
I don't know if it was the first of the seven, but it may have been. But that was the first time we actually read it. And all I can say was I burst into tears immediately reading this story, thinking, this isn't our family. You know, it was an incredible thing for Alex to be able to be immersed in that growing up the way we all were. But he was a storyteller, so he could actually pull back enough to write the story beginning to end. I don't have that gift. So when I read it, I was thinking, this is a story about someone else. You know, it was enraging, it was heartbreaking, yet it was beautiful all at the same time. So many mixed emotions as I read that story. I was reading it aloud with my husband, and I remember I was just crying the whole time because it was horrific. Many parts of it were horrific. Again, it was the first time we'd read it. So.
And, you know, actually for me, as someone who grew up in the Philippines and moved here when I was 12, even the use of the word slave was, you know, Melissa and I were talking about this, and Melissa has done really an amazing job just explaining to people how this story came about, because the process. And you gave an interview in which you said, you know, quote, slavery is the most inflammatory word you could use to describe a situation, but it's also the most accurate word. And you know, after really looking back at the relationship and the way Lola was treated, this was the most accurate word. So I wanted to ask you, Melissa, like, you mentioned to me that this was deliberate in Alex's part, like to choose that word and to go there. Why?
Yeah, we were talking, and you had thought that the Atlantic selected that word.
Yes, that's what I thought.
Yeah, people who weren't familiar with Filipino culture just decided to slap that on a headline and make clickbait out of it. But Alex wanted to use that word because he wanted to be brutally honest about what was happening. And so he chose it. It was the first time that the family had ever seen that word used to describe Lola.
And how did he explain it to you?
Just, you know, we really didn't talk about it, except the fact that he wanted to be honest about what was happening. And he didn't want to whitewash anything. So I think if you're going to be honest, that's the word he chose to use.
And Link, kind of to your point, like when you were reading the draft, you were thinking, this is not my family. What was your, you know, again, the word slave, like what was your reaction to that?
It was a word we never uttered or even thought of growing up. You know, Lola was to us, to the kids, the siblings, our mother figure. I mean, she raised us. She was the constant. She was the nurturer. Fed us, you know, and she was the, because of that, I think we, the word slave just didn't even play in our heads. She was our parent, our family. Yeah. And Lola also regarded us as her children, practically. I mean, when we were growing up, it was very hard to describe her relationship because we always said she was our grandmother. And when we introduced Lola to people, but as we got older, we started realizing, no, she's not our grandmother, but she certainly played a mother figure to all of us. So again, when I read the word slave and my siblings too, I think we were all, it was horrifying actually to read it. And I understand now in retrospect why Alex chose that.
Was there ever a conversation between the siblings, you know, asking Alex, hey, you know, why are you going there? Again, I brought up the whole point of hiyak, right? Mm-hmm. Like, there are certain things that you don't talk beyond the family. And now this is like not just within the family. This is something that he was going to publish. So what was the conversation around that?
There wasn't conversation about it. When he shared the story with us in October last year, we all read it individually. You know, we're all living in our, you know, where we all each live. And we think we talked phone calls individually going, wow, did you read that? And we winced. I mean, I'm sure we all winced at the word slave, again, because we never regarded Lola as such. But we never questioned Alex. You know, we trusted Alex's, the way he was thinking. He's the master storyteller. We trusted that he chose his words very deliberately and intentionally. So we when the Atlantic said, do you want the story to run? Even with his passing, we all absolutely said yes. We want to honor him.
So there was no hesitation at all when that come up. And Melissa, thank you for bringing that up, because I actually really thought it was the Atlantic's clickbait strategy to put the word slave in there. Because in my head, I'm thinking, how many Filipino-American editors are there in magazines across this country? And would they understand kind of the cultural nuances of being Filipino? And, you know, growing up, were you having katulong? Some people know what katulong is, which is basically having help. Like, in the Philippines, even people who have help, right? Like, that's the layer of poverty. Like, the katulongs have their own katulongs, right? So it was kind of interesting kind of reading that and trying to understand where that was coming from. And back to the story, I mean, I could just go on and on about the story, but one of the things I wanted to ask both of you is, after your mom died, Ling, there was a lot of effort from the siblings to take Lola back to the province of the Philippines, to Tarlac, right? To even build her a home. Why did she resist that?
You know, even before Mom passed away, we would come visit. You know, by this time we were adult kids with our own lives and families, and we'd come visit, and Lola would share, you know, some happenings that have taken place in the house, and Lola always would share and say, but don't tell your mother, don't tell. So we would listen, and we would just plead with her, why are you staying? You know, we're all grown now. Why are you staying? And that's when we would offer to either have her live with, you know, one of us, to go home. We would pay for her to go back home to Tarlac, or to build a house for her in Tarlac. And no, Lola would just not have it. She would just not have it. And that was a devotion that I don't think to this day we can comprehend the relationship that she and Mom had and why she wouldn't go, why she would choose to stay.
And now, this is to both you, both Melissa and Ling, like, now that Lola's story is so out there and people have put into it what they put into it, you know, the story itself, it's so rich, there's a lot there, but even just from that video and the other videos that you've shared with me, for example, that was created kind of from the family, right, the album of Lola, like, how do you want her to be remembered as your family member?
I actually have been writing down some thoughts, you know, anticipating this, and I if I can share just a few snippets from the eulogy, the part of the
please.
Eulogy that I wrote when she passed. Yesterday, Pastor John asked us how we would describe Lola, her life, the person she was. Humility, kindness, purity, sacrifice, selfless, unconditional love. Lola left a gentle but everlasting imprint on all whom she raised, cared for, met for the first time, cooked for, laughed with, cried with. She was the most selfless person, which in turn made us want to do for her whatever we could. And we know there are at least a few of us who look back and realize we could have done more. But Lola wouldn't want us to live that way with regret. Never once in my 48 years I ever heard Lola say she deserved anything. Yet she was the most deserving person of anything on earth she wanted. And now, the one microscopic thing we can hang on to in all the blackness, bottomless heartache we feel is that she is in heaven now receiving the abundance of blessings she always deserved.
How about you, Melissa? Like, how would you want to remember her?
So I remember Lola. I lived with her at the end of her life. I didn't grow up with her like you did. And so she lived with us in our home in Edmonds for 12 years, and she was the center of our family. And she was I thought everybody came to our house to see me. But after she died, I realized that it wasn't me. Everybody was coming to see her. I mean, that's really what it was. And then after she died, I felt like our family dispersed a little bit because she wasn't there holding us together. So she was the glue. And even after, your mom died, but your guys' dad, Frank, would come to our house, and they were friends by the end. And he deferred to her all the time. He had so much respect for her. So that's a part of Lola that you don't really see in the story, that at the end she was the matriarch and she was the glue. It wasn't me.
And why do you think, by the way, thank you for bringing that up. Why do you think that was the case? Why wasn't there more of that in the story? Kind of the fact that she was the matriarch of this family.
Do I dare say, because I know this is being live streamed, but in the earlier versions that we saw, there was more about that, about Lola as more than just being enslaved.
Yeah.
And then I think as it went through the editing process, just for whatever reason,
as any story goes through,
stripped away, and it tended to focus more on the brutality of it. Mm-hmm. You know, when we sent in pictures for the magazine to use, we wanted to send the happy picture.
Yes, actually, I was struck by that, by the photos in the magazine.
Yeah.
But yeah.
And but none of the happy pictures really made it in.
Right. I think that it contradicted somewhat the main theme of Alex's storytelling, to send in these pictures of the five kids with Lola kind of laying across our laps or something like that. I mean, there were many, many photos like that and many memories like that. And we asked, you know, can we have this one in the story? And you know, that it was chosen. No, other photos were chosen.
But I think the complexity of how she was in real, I mean, there's the story that was published and then there's her. Right, and I think it's kind of important to make sure that we differentiate in that way. And actually, now I'm really curious. I mean, Melissa and I didn't know each other. I just knew her when Twitter started. Like when the article was published, the Twitter storm about it was pretty. I've never seen so many Filipinos on Twitter who's not talking about Manny Pacquiao, and it was pretty incredible. And so I jumped right on, and without knowing Melissa, felt very protective of, maybe because I'm a writer myself, what happens when you put a story out there and people put into it what they put into it. And so I wanted to ask both of you, and especially Melissa, being out there publicly about this, like what was it like dealing with the wide range of reaction from people?
Well, first of all, thanks for coming to my defense on Twitter. And Lingai and I were in a Macy's in Portland when you called me.
Oh.
For the first time. It was the first time we ever talked.
I was with my Lolas, by the way.
Yeah,
I was with three Lolas in D.C. And then you
and we were, and yeah. we were shopping at a Macy's. And I said to you, you are the only other journalist who I think can understand Alex, because if you guys know Jose's work, he's just put himself out there and you've exposed yourself personally to bring a bigger issue to life.
Yeah.
And so, I thought you're the only person who really understands this. And you said to me, but the difference between me and Alex is that I'm alive to defend myself.
Yeah.
And Alex wasn't. So huge range of reaction. And Alex would say that it's all valid. He would say, bring it on. Let's discuss this. He would love to be here with you guys right now and take all of your questions. And I guess I'd say that is true, and people should be, you know, really pissed off about, you know, what was said about Lola or how Lola was treated. But the one reaction that made me very upset was the Seattle Times. The way that the Seattle Times wrote about, they had originally done an obit about Lola 5 years ago, and then the obit writer felt the need to go back and do a whole other story about how Alex basically lied to her by omission, by not saying in the obit that she was a slave. And the Seattle Times, they didn't bother to call any family members. They didn't do any reporting. They just wrote this story.
Is there anybody here from the Seattle Times? Just kidding.
But
just
you guys, kidding. If you are, the Seattle Times knows how I feel about this. So it's not a secret. But... But yeah, so So, you know, I was able to slip in a quote because somebody there in the newsroom gave me a heads up, so I got a quote into the story, but there was no journalism done. It was a story, and, you know, I get a call from Dylan, my stepdaughter, from work. When the story came out, she was bawling, couldn't work because of the Seattle Times story, and then I get a call from Lingai, just really upset about it. So of all the reactions, it's all valid, but I just was really disappointed with the way that the Seattle Times chose to write about the story. I mean, that's not journalism to me, what they did.
But I wanted to kind of go back. Like, was there a time, especially right, like the first 72 hours when the story was published online, and you were out there, was there ever a time you were like, ugh, I'm going to stop. I have to stop looking at this. Or did you feel that since Alex is not here, that you needed to do that?
You know, I think I was doing pretty good at not letting the criticism get to me until that Seattle Times article came out. And then after that, I just said, there is no way any news media is going to do a story about Alex if our family isn't interviewed for it. And so that's when, you know, KUOW called and asked if I wanted to be on, and People Magazine interviewed Ling and my sister-in-law, Indai. We don't want to be out here talking about this. We're still grieving. My husband just died a few months ago. But I didn't feel like we could let news media tell the story without the family. I wish I could just give up and shut it all off. But I just really feel like I need to stand up for what Alex was trying to do.
Ling, what was some of the hardest kind of reaction for you to swallow?
Well, certainly, I'm human, so we are human, our siblings, and when we read very hurtful words like about mom, who we loved also, but about, you know, the T-Zons should all burn in hell or be deported, or, you know, all kinds of awful things, or about Alex only writing the story for his own kind of self-edification and his own guilt. And those were very hard words to read, very hurtful and hard, but again, valid as far as the reaction, you know, that gut reaction people had when they read the story, saw the word slavery, read the details of some of those horrible things that Lola endured. I understand. I think we siblings understand the reactions. Didn't make it any easier to take or read. And yes, at some point, you know, it was one of those things. There was overwhelming support. I think there was overwhelming support globally saying how courageous and the beauty of Lola's spirit and all of that. But then there was that small minority, I think, who was very vocal through Twitter and other medium. And it was hard not to read it, although it came to a point where it was like, I can't anymore. I can't read any more words about our family, you know, whether there was truth in some of what they were saying or not.
Were there reactions that you thought were just thoughtful and beautiful? I'm just curious about that as well, because I think for me, all I was seeing was kind of the loudness of some of the negativity, but I'm sure that there was, whatever that may be, I'm just curious from your perspective.
Yes, definitely. There were, in fact, The Atlantic compiled some of the more very supportive, just beautiful comments for the family so that we had that. But, you know, I think a lot of the really positive, empowering comments that came and the encouraging comments were about Lola's humanity and her spirit and her ability to have gone through that for most of her life, yet she still rose above all that and showed unconditional love, kindness, humility, I mean, in every part of her life. So that was that part that was so beautiful about the story, you know, and that Alex tried to portray that in how much she was loved by so many people, how many people she touched. And, you know, Lola was ordinary, but she lived an extraordinary life in that way, how many people she touched.
Melissa?
Yeah, I would just add to that my favorite comments were the ones where people said, I fell in love with Lola too. And I wish you guys could actually get could have met her because she was just an amazing human being. But I think Alex did do a good job of making people fall in love with her. And then there was another really beautiful comment that I got on Twitter just about, someone said, I wish there was a word for when you read something that you love and then you realize the person who wrote it just died. Because that's heartbreaking and beautiful at the same time.
For me, like the beginning of the story, and actually I wanted to make sure that I asked both of you these questions, like that journey with the ashes. So reading about that, I mean, I had my own emotions. What was it like for you to experience that with Alex before he even wrote it? You know, looking back now in this conversation, you said that September 2016 was when everything kind of fell into place, right? Like, do you remember the memories from Alex about what was that like for him to go back with ashes?
I do. And that's one of the questions that we get a lot is, why did it take him so long to bring the ashes? And he actually brought them kind of subversively, because I think you can't just bring ashes to the Philippines without fees and taxes and everything. So we had to hide it. That's why it was in a plastic box. We get a lot of criticism about why was it in a plastic black box. But anyway, so he made the trip by himself, and I remember him taking the ashes off of our mantle, and I thought, wow, you're taking all of the ashes? That was kind of hard for me to see him do that. And so he went off to the Philippines, and the rest of us went to a wedding in Oakland. And then we were at a wedding in Oakland for our niece, and he sent us all pictures of the family in Myeongtuk with the ashes, and it was just really, the pictures were just amazing. We were blown away. And I know it was a very powerful journey for him too, because even though Lola had made several trips to Myeongtuk, I think he was just still surprised at how much they loved her and how much grieving and wailing there was. And and so I think that closure is possibly what made it so easy for him to write the story in September. So he did that trip in July, and then he started writing the story in September.
What was your memory of it, the way Alex told you about it?
Yeah, Alex, he videotaped part of that. Oh. The video that he sent to us was from the view of him driving, you know, the driver in the jeepney, I believe, and driving into the province. So you really got the feel, you know, you got the feel of the anticipation of this, the feelings he must have been having as far as not knowing how he would be received, how they would react. And so he really gave us that feeling, that sense of being there.
And Ling, like, what was through the years the interaction between his family, her family in Tarlac, and your family? Was there a lot of interaction at all, or...?
Not so much. I mean, one of our brothers, Albert, was a missionary in the Philippines for 10 years. So he and his family were there. So they would go to the province occasionally to be there when Lola would come to visit from the States. That interaction would happen, but you know, day-to-day, month-to-month, or, you know, we didn't really have any interaction with Lola's family in Tarlac until recently.
And then, actually, I wanted to ask about that. What has that been like? So now there's a story, it's an international story, right? I mean, I don't think I've heard from as many cousins in the Philippines since I came out as undocumented until this story came out. They're like, hey, do you know this reporter? I'm like, no, I actually don't know him. But, like, what has it been like dealing with that kind of, that attention from the Philippines and even from Lola's family members?
It's, you know, it hasn't been easy. This has been really hard for Lola's family because they were just as shocked as we were when this story came out. And so you can imagine, you know, they had a family member who they didn't see for a long time. And Lola did get back in touch with them and visit them pretty regularly at the end of her life. But just if you can imagine, you know, being them and then reading about all the brutality that she faced, it's been very difficult for them, and they are not used to media attention, and they live in this province, and suddenly all this media were coming knocking on their doors, and they didn't know what to do, and they were, you know, it was just, it was hard for them.
And actually, I remember one of the people I talked to right after the article was published was Ai-Jen Poo from the National Domestic Workers Alliance. It's a wonderful organization if you don't know about it. Because Ai-Jen and I were just talking about, here's the story, right? And the fact that that is still happening, right? That there's still absolutely that kind of servitude all around us. And actually, I wanted to ask both of you, like, given that this story, that Alex's story in some ways has been a catalyst for kind of opening this conversation, right? What else do you think can happen in terms of starting that conversation and making sure we're talking about the fact that that's still happening?
Well, just awareness. I mean, I know we have some community partner tables here that hopefully everyone will have a time to look at, but that definitely is a big part of why we're having this conversation, I think, is to bring to light that this is happening not just in the Philippines, it's happening in so many other countries and nations, and I think that all of us can somehow get involved, right? We need to find out how we can get involved and keep bringing awareness to, you know, stop or prevent whatever laws or loopholes are out there that allow this to continue to happen, you know, in the Philippines or here in the U.S., actually.
Yeah, it's awareness and understanding of what slavery can look like in today. Because a lot of people think of institutionalized slavery, you know, in American history, but it can look different. And so I think this is a way of showing how different it can look.
And Ling, I wanted to ask you specifically, given, you know, the shock of first reading that draft, like, what did it feel like to read that draft and realizing that this was happening in your family and you didn't know about it?
I was angry. I was so angry at my parents. So a lot of, again, Alex hadn't shared the contents of the story with us. So when I read it from beginning to end, there were parts I wasn't even aware of, right? I was young. We were very young kids. But that it was happening, and there was a lot of abuse, I think, early on when we were all kids or not even born, when, you know, Lola had been with Mom and Dad for over 20 years, I believe, before the family moved to the U.S. So hearing and reading some of the what Lola endured in those early years was just heartbreaking. And, you know, as we got older and as, we, you know, when we moved to the U.S., there was less of the physical abuse, let's say. I saw it one time when I was 9. But the emotional and verbal abuse continued for, you know, most of the time that my mom was alive. So there was a mixture of guilt and shame and just incredulous that this was happening. It happened while we were all these little kids running around and moving 7 times and, you know, not understanding it. You know, when we were kids, there was definitely a contradiction in the way we were being taught and what we were observing, right? Respect your elders. But that wasn't happening, right? In our, what we saw every day. So
what was getting lost in the translation? I think too often in immigrant families, right? Mm-hmm. There's the subtext.
Yeah.
And there's just the stuff that you just don't talk about. Was this just one of those things? Just like, it was just not, Lola was just there. You know that she was there, but her history, mm-hmm. like when did you start it being intrigued or curious about that?
Well, Alex was the journalist from early on. So I think he interviewed Lola, Mom, Dad, you know, it was just part of his nature. I think the rest of us, and I guess I can just speak for myself, I only wished that I would have spent more time inquiring about those days. I didn't know about some of the examples that Alex wrote. I wasn't aware. And I think that's the part that was infuriating and so hard to read, that she went through that. You know, she actually went through those things and, you know, we didn't talk about it. Our parents didn't talk about it, certainly. And Lola didn't either. You know, Lola didn't share that with us kids.
Melissa, when you and I first spoke, I remember you saying to me that in some ways you thought that and you think that this was the story that Alex was born to write, that this is what I've been working on. And, you know, let's also be, let's make sure we contextualize this properly. We're talking about a journalist. Like, Alex was not a superficial crash and burn journalist. Alex was a contextual storyteller who believed in the power of complex stories to liberate people, right? The story of the missing family members in Alaska, his memoir. If you haven't read Alex's memoir, by the way, it's one of the few memoirs about Asian male masculinity that exists anywhere in American, kind of the English American language in that way. But why did you say that? Why do you say that in some ways this is the story that he had been kind of, you know, working for his entire life?
He told me that. He specifically said at least five years ago that this was a story that he was born to write, and he was frustrated because it wasn't coming out then. In 5 years ago, he couldn't make it happen. And Alex believed that every person had an epic story. So if you were just talking to him, he didn't like to make small talk. He wanted to know what your epic story was. He always dove into it, and that's why, you know, he loved journalism so much. It was such a good fit for him. He struggled with his identity as an Asian male growing up in America, struggled with it his whole life, but then through journalism, he found his way, because he kept interviewing outsiders, marginalized people, indigenous people, and he started to find himself through that process. And if you guys don't mind, I brought his private journal, and there were a couple things I was going to read that indicate how important this story was to him. So is that cool?
Oh, please, yes. Okay.
And I never read any of this until after he passed away. So, and I just read some of it this morning, and the Gates Foundation let me use the meditation room here, and I was reading it and crying, so hopefully I won't cry. But I'm just going to read parts of it. This is dated 11-23-11. And Lola, when did Lola die? 11?
November 7, 2011.
So this was a few weeks after Lola died. He says, "Dear Lola, I am so sad you're gone, sadder than I thought I would be, because a part of me didn't think you could die. You were always so strong, so sturdy, like a tree trunk. You were always there. From the first moment I opened my eyes, you were there. You have known me since my first breath. I have known you for all my 52 years. I have not known life without you, and now you're gone, and I am missing you terribly. It is an ache in my body, an ache, a heaviness, a gnawing around the edges of my own heart, my heart, your heart." And then I just wanted to skip over to this part. "I have been so sad about your life for most of my life. I tried to write a book about it, but no publishers were interested. Not very commercial, they said. The story of a small, poor, indigenous woman who lived as a slave for most of her life. That's when all of us kids fell in love with you. We pitied you, and we loved you more. We all wanted to set you free, but you didn't seem to want to be free. Why was that, Lola? I hope you're free now. I hope you are as free as the wind in the mountains of your beloved Myuntuk." And then another thing about Lola, when she lived with us, Alex hated having the TV on. He hated the noise of the TV, but Lola loved watching the Filipino channel. And so this was the soap operas and the game shows, and so they would always get into a fight about this. So Alex says, "That damn TV. I'm sorry about being so mean about the TV, Lola. I just didn't want Maya to watch so much of it. But anyway, I hope, Lola, that where you are, it is the Filipino channel all day, every day, and that you're the star of it." And then last, this is the very last of it. So they fought about the TV, and Alex was really cranky to be around a lot of the time. So he says, Lola, I hope you'll forgive me. I hope I am a different person the next time we meet. I don't have great hopes that we will meet again because I don't believe in the Christian heaven and hell anymore. But I would be delighted to be wrong, and I would be ecstatic to see you and hug you very tightly and for a very long time. Right now, there's nothing I want more. You are the best person I'll ever know. And even though you don't care about such things, I want you to know it.
Oh, I'm sorry. Now I have to ask a question that you probably don't want me to ask, but I have to ask the question. What do you think they're talking about up there?
I'm pretty sure they're talking about us right now. Pretty sure.
Like proud or kind of like, you know, like what would they be saying?
I think they're saying, you go, Ling and Mies and Jose.
Before I turn into questions, I wanted to ask this last thing. And I'm really happy that Ling and Melissa both brought this up, which is that if Alex were here, he would have enjoyed how much people are dissecting and debating the story. That's what writers do. We write something, hopefully it sparks something in other people and people talk about it, right? And so I'm curious, like, if he were here with us, I don't want to use the word defending because I think that comes from a posture of, you know, I was in a few of my own Twitter spats with people, specifically Filipino-American people, who said, why did he write the story? How embarrassing, all of that. And all I could say was, we should all be thankful that he had the courage and the humility to write it. Because you cannot have read that story page to page to page and not felt the angst, the pain, the anger, right? And I think above all, the humility in being able to tell the story. So I wanted to ask you, like, what would he say? Like, how would he talk about this story to people here with us today?
I think he would be filling in more of the blanks, more of the gaps in the story that weren't all there. So I think that he could take it to the next level and explain more about what his thought process was instead of us just guessing about it. So I think he could have provided more background and context.
Yeah, I think there were some, you know, you can't tell the whole story, right? I mean, he definitely shared as much as he could to paint that picture of Lola's life, but there were definitely things that, you know, in the reactions, people were asking questions like, you know, did Lola have any life outside of the home, and things like that. And I think Alex would be answering that right now, and he would be actually probably channeling through us what to say. But, you know, for example, you know, Lola, after the immigration bill passed in 1986. It took a couple of years, but Lola, you know, the kids actually rallied and helped her to get her citizenship, and so she was able to get a job outside the home, which she loved. In the brochure, there's a picture of her with wearing the hat, I think, the NORPAC hat. But she worked there for 12 years, so it was something that she was so proud of. You know, it was an ability for her to make her money, to send some of that home, and just that sense of pride, right, to be able to do that. So that was just one of those things that wasn't necessarily in the story, but I think it was an important point that Alex would have shared eventually had he been here.
Before we take your questions, I kind of wanted to share something. I don't know how many of you read this, how many times you read the story. I read it 4 times. The fourth time I read it, I started thinking about, for some reason, Toni Morrison. Toni Morrison gave, in my opinion, probably one of the best speeches ever about the power of language when she accepted her Nobel for Literature in 1993, which incidentally is when I moved to this country. And one of the things that she said in this speech was this idea that, you know, we die, right? Like, that may be the meaning of life, but we do language. That is the measure of our lives. And in as I was rereading Alex's story and the way he chronicled, I think it's really important that we say Lola's full name, Eudocia Tomas Pulido. Eudocia Tomas Pulido. I started thinking of this part in Toni Morrison's speech when she said, the vitality of language lies in its ability to lime the actual, imagined, and possible lives of its speakers, readers, writers. Language can never pin down slavery, genocide, war, nor should it yearn for the arrogance to be able to do so. Its force, its felicity, is in its reach toward the ineffable. I think Alex, in this story, reached for that. And I think he reached it to the fullest capacity possible.
Thanks for streaming this episode of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Melissa Tizon, Ling Tizon Quillen, and Jose Antonio Vargas spoke at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation Visitors Center on September 6th. Thank you to Sonia Harris for our recording. You can hear the full recording on our website, kuow.org. Tune in again soon.